We were talking last time of the dialogue with the materialists. And I had suggested that there are two more dialogues apart from the dialogues that I had last time. So I shall first deal with these two dialogues. The first of these two dialogues does not put forward materialism openly as a basic argument. It simply says, look at the world and look what is happening in the world. Things happen pell-mell. A freak of will of somebody changes the course of history. If a certain king had not to go for a walk on a particular day, history would have been quite different. A simple thing like this creates lots of events which are great. And by taking examples of history, it concludes that the world is a matter of chance. This is a theory of chance. Things are happening in the world by means of no design. In fact, there is nothing like design at all in this world. But if you point out that there are so many things which are happening in the world which have an order. The sun rises in the morning in the east. The planets move in a particular direction, in a particular speed, so that you can predict the exact time when eclipse, for example, will take place. In advance, many, many years in advance. Therefore, to say that the world is merely a world of chance is not true. So, the chancist modifies his position and he says, of course, basically it is chance, but it is self-organizing chance. It's a new word. Self-organizing chance. The whole world is nothing but a self-organizing chance. He admits that there is a paradox. Chance and self-organization do not go together because the very fact of organizing, organization means order, regularity, predictability. He admits it is true, but he says even that has happened by chance. Why does sun rise in the east every day? By chance. It so happens, chance is like that, that every day it happens by chance. Now this theory has behind it actually materialism, because only if the ultimate reality is matter, which is unconscious, that it can produce a world of chance. Only if ultimate reality is unconscious, that there can be freak of will and unpredictable things. But there are two facts which this theory cannot answer. If everything is by chance, how is it that in the process of evolution, at a certain stage, the unconscious has given rise to consciousness? The human beings have come into existence much after the birth of matter and life. The birth of mind is much later. This is one fact which it is not able to answer. How could unconsciousness produce consciousness? Secondly, how is it that the consciousness which is born in the form of the mind always tends to order its own ideas. Whenever mind begins to work, it immediately tries to organize its perceptions, its ideas, and wants to organize things in a certain sense of unity. Why is it that chance being the parent, the child is opposed to chance? The child does not like to follow the method of chance. In all its operations, it follows the methods of design. These two questions, the chances theory is not able to answer. But he still says, all this is by chance. A very easy statement, all this is by chance. Even that production of consciousness out of unconscious is by chance. Even the production of the mind which imposes design in the world is by chance. Therefore, the last answer that we can give to the theory of chance is that even if it is right, even if this theory is right, it will be right only by chance. If everything is chance, then his theory also can be right only by means of chance, not necessarily a right theory. This is the only answer that can really defeat this position. That if it happens to be right, it will not be right because it is really right, but only because of chance it is right. And that which is right by chance is not really right. So this is one special theory of materialism. Now we come to the last theory of materialism. Now this theory also follows basically theory of chance, but in a more sophisticated manner. It says that the world consists of events. And the only statement you can make which is indubitable is that there are events. Only one statement. Nobody can refute this statement that there are events. Now, events have no intrinsic relationship with each other. According to the theory which regards consciousness as the root of the universe, the relationship between one event and the other is determined by underlying unity. Because there is a kind of a design, and all design implies a unity. Therefore, everything that happens in the world has an internal relationship with the other event. No event occurs without having an intrinsic relationship with any other event. But this theory maintains that every event has no relationship with any other event. Every event is independent of the other. Between one event and the other, there is a gap, a vacuum. Now, this is the theory which was advanced basically to support materialism. Because according to materialism, there is no conscious design. And conscious design implies unity. Unity means interrelationship, which is intrinsic. Therefore, to oppose this theory has been put forward that all events in the world happen without any relationship with the other. It may not use the word chance, but actually it comes to the same theory that every event, if it happens without any connection with another event, it is by chance. It may not use the word chance, but it is another version of the same theory, but with the sophistication of the idea of relationship. That the relationship, according to this theory, is external, not internal. The relationship between one event and the other is not intrinsic, but external. It is simply superimposed upon it by our thinking. In itself, One event has no connection with another event. Every event is atomistic. According to this theory, time, for example, consists of moments, and each moment is like a drop. Between one moment and the other, there is no interval as such. There is no interval of time. Between one event and the other, there is interval, but the interval is a vacuum. There is nothing between the two.
No time.
That is the whole point. This theory maintains that between one event and the other, there is no duration. Every event occurs by itself. It's like a drop. Suddenly, a drop, an event takes place. Then nothing happens for some time. Suddenly something happens. Another event takes place. So according to this theory, time is not a succession of moments. It is simply a moment followed by vacuum, followed by another moment. So between one moment and the other, there is no relationship. This is also called the atomic theory of events. Every event is atomic. It has no connection with the other. Now, Bertrand Russell is one of the proponents of this theory. And he wanted to show that this theory is so powerfully valid, and if it is established thoroughly, then the hypothesis of consciousness can be removed altogether forever. But he had one big difficulty. He was a very honest thinker. He tried his best to prove this theory. And to prove this theory, he tried to show that every event is atomic. And every event being atomic, he said, every event can be described atomistically. If every event is atomic, it can even be described atomically. That is to say, you speak only one word, no other word at all, and yet that event can be described. So he wanted to invent a new language, appropriate to this kind of a theory, that every event is indifferent of the other. So we should be able to speak also in such a way that each event is complete by itself, another event is complete by itself, a third event is complete by itself, having no interconnection between them. Or if relations are there, they are only external. He used to give the example of uncle and nephew. Uncle is an event, nephew is an event. Now it is true that there is no uncle without a nephew and no nephew without an uncle. But uncle could have existed even without a nephew in himself. And a nephew could have existed even if uncle were not to exist. So he said that nephew-uncle relationship is external. It is not that nephew must exist in order that uncle exists. Relationship of course must exist. For a relationship, this interdependence is necessary. But for the actual existence of the uncle, presence of nephew is not necessary and vice versa. But the moment you use the word uncle and nephew, relationship is established. So he wanted to find a new language in which you don't have to use the word nephew and uncle. Because the moment you use this term, it gives an impression that nephew can't exist without uncle, uncle can't exist without a nephew. He went on searching, ultimately he said, I will use language in which there will be only one word, this.
This,
that's all. Not at all. Only one word. You indicate this, it is atomic. This is atomic. That is atomic. So each word has only one word, namely this. If you want to indicate, don't use a long language in which this is so and so, that is so and so. Simply say this. He went to that land. But then he admitted that the moment I said this, I am obliged to imply that this is different from that. Otherwise, how can I indicate this? If I do not at the same time indicate it is different from the other, I can't indicate this at all. So he came to the conclusion, ultimately, that this still has not worked. And he had a program in his life that one day he will try to find out a language which will be purely atomic, which he could not until the end of his life. In any case, it only shows that the theory of materialism, even in its extreme effort, fails. Even in the extreme effort, you grant everything. So you will see that all the dialogues that we have so far, in each dialogue, the materialist is not able to answer ultimately. Now let us take the other way around. Let us assume that consciousness is at the root of things. Not matter, but consciousness is at the root of the whole universe. Can we then explain the universe? Now, just as the materialist has a difficulty in explaining consciousness coming out of matter, similarly, the theory of consciousness have a big difficulty because of the presence of matter. If everything is conscious, how can there be matter which is unconscious? This is the big blockade for the theory of consciousness. How can there be matter which is unconscious if ultimate reality is consciousness?
But they argue that they say that it is only in your consciousness that you perceive matter. So after that argument, we do not want to proceed. They say that it is in your consciousness that you perceive matter. If you didn't have consciousness, you won't perceive matter.
Yes, but that argument is not conclusive.
So how do you go ahead in that?
It is argued on behalf of the materialists that it is true that as far as you are concerned, for you, things exist only so long as you are in consciousness. But how do you prove that they don't exist when your consciousness is not present? It is true that when you perceive a thing, then it is in your perception that the thing exists. But does it prove, therefore, that when your consciousness is not at work, that thing still continues or does not continue to exist? For example, we had the theory of a philosopher who said that if an idealist is right, idealist is one who regards consciousness at the root of things, as opposed to materialist. So he said, if idealist is right, then the train, as it enters into the platform, it begins to have wheels. When it goes out of the platform, it ceases to have wheels. Why? Because when the train is moving in a place where nobody is around to see, you can of course see the wagons because you are seated or you are experiencing it, but you are not seeing the wheels. So wheels must not be existing at that time. So the absurdity will be that wheels come into existence when the train enters into a platform, because there human beings are all around on the platform, so they can see the wheels. So do you mean to say that the wheels come into existence when the train enters into the platform, and they cease to have to be there when the train goes out of the platform? But your argument remains. As far as you are concerned, wheels exist only because you see them. If you are not there to see, you are not even there to make a statement that the wheels exist. But this argument does not stand very powerfully because of another reason also. that if things exist only because you see them, then how is it that you cannot see things at your will? If things exist only because you see them, how is it that you cannot see things at your will? How is it you are obliged to see this machine and you are not able to see here a river? Think of a river. If river exists upon your thinking or upon your seeing, then as soon as you think of a river, river must come into existence. It doesn't come into existence. Therefore, there must be a reality independent of your thinking. And therefore, this Agulis theory fails in answering this question. But idealist theory, as I told you, has an upper hand when we discuss all the theories of materialism. Even if things exist independent of your perception, you have many problems to answer. And each question we have raised up till now, six theories we have presented. In six different forms, we have presented materialism. And in each theory, ultimately it fails to answer. Therefore, the theory of idealism is stronger
than
the materialist, as compared to materialist. But now the idealist has this problem. How do you show that from consciousness matter can come into existence? If everything is consciousness, how can there be unconsciousness at all? Now, in answer to this question, it is said that whatever is unconscious is itself a mode of consciousness. That is, unconsciousness is not opposed to consciousness. It is itself a mode of consciousness. And the example is that of sleep. When you go to sleep, what happens? Your consciousness, as you normally understand it, is suspended. But it is not destroyed. When you wake up, you can take up the thread with the past. And how can you take up the thread with the past if there was a real loss of consciousness? We also know that when there is sleep, whatever senses normally observe, they don't observe anymore. My ears may be as wide open as now, and yet in the sleep condition, I don't hear the noise. Even if the noise takes place around me, I don't hear the noise. Therefore, unconsciousness is simply a mode of consciousness. This theory therefore simply wants to argue that consciousness is not equal to mental consciousness. If you mean by consciousness mental consciousness, then of course you can't explain sleep. You can't explain unconsciousness. You can't explain matter. But if consciousness has different kinds of grades, of such a kind that even the suspension of consciousness is a state of consciousness, then you can explain the emergence of matter out of consciousness. And how do you explain? By means of what is called self-limitation. There is a power of self-limitation in the consciousness. It's a special kind of power. Just as power of self-expression is a power, the power of self-limitation is also a power. I know that a certain thing need not be spoken in the presence of a child. Therefore, I limit my expression. But that limitation requires a power. It's a very special power. It is a result of a consciousness. That power itself is exercised by a special power of consciousness. Therefore, all self-limitation is a deliberate action. Deliberate means conscious. So, according to this theory, consciousness can explain unconsciousness by pointing out that unconsciousness is a deliberate action of consciousness to limit its consciousness. If we therefore put a hypothesis that the whole world is originally a consciousness having the power of self-limitation, then that power of self-limitation can be of various degrees. Greater limitation, lower limitation, higher limitation, intense limitation, acute limitation, various kinds of limitations are possible. You can have even the intensest limitation which can become inconscience. Inconscience is consciousness limiting itself to such an acute point that it even does not remember that it is deliberately limiting itself. It's an acute self-limitation.
Okay, how is it different from ignorance?
Ignorance is intermediate between inconscience and supreme consciousness. Limitation of consciousness, when it is middle point, it is ignorance. When it is acute, it is inconscience.
But you said it's a voluntary limitation, just as you said.
That's right.
So, how does that differ from ignorance?
Ignorance is also self-limited ignorance. We are all ignorant. And if you ask a question as to how this ignorance has come about, if you go into the history of it, you will find that at a given time, you decided that you want to be limited in your consciousness. If you had not decided, you would not have become ignorant.
No, what I didn't understand was that how is it different from, just as you said, that we voluntarily limit as to what we have to say in front of a child or not. So, that is not ignorance, that is because of knowledge.
That's right.
So, where is the difference here?
Ignorance also is an act of knowledge. In fact, that is the speciality of ignorance. Ignorance itself is a form of knowledge. That is why in the Ishopanishad, it is said that vidya cha avidya. If you follow only avidya, you will be in ignorance. But if you follow vidya alone, you will be in a greater ignorance. Because you are omitting something that is also a form of knowledge. Avidya and vidya both combined together give you really the true knowledge. The totality of knowledge is both to have vidya and avidya.
So, vidya will overcome it.
That's right. And also the creation of avidya is a result of a deliberate action on your part.
Of willing the knowledge.
Of willing the knowledge. If you had not exercised that will, you would not have become ignorant. But you have forgotten it because you have decided that you will even forget that. It becomes acute to that point. You have become so acutely ignorant that you have forgotten that you have taken a voluntary decision to become ignorant. But if you go back into the history of your ignorance, you will find that you have taken a decision at a given time. That you will deliberately limit yourself and play with ignorance. That is the theory of Ila. That all ignorance is a play. You have decided to play, to hide yourself, and then having hidden yourself, you try to find yourself out. And then ultimately when you decide that you want to unveil yourself, then only you become conscious of yourself. So in both the cases it's a question of decision. It's a deliberate action. So So, in fact, there is a chapter in the Life Divine where Sri Aurobindo has described ignorance as a process of knowledge. And this is a knowledge which helps us very much in dealing with the world, because wherever you see ignorance, you can be sure that there is a working of knowledge somewhere. Mere ignorance is not really ignorance. Even a child when he is ignorant, if you really observe perfectly, you will find that there is a spark of knowledge which is constantly illuminating itself in some of its most important activities. Just as the body which is diseased has an automatic tendency to become healthy. Healing is an automatic process of the body. Even if you are very ill, everybody tries to become healthy. In fact, all doctors assure you that they are only instruments, external instruments. They put the condition of the body in such a condition that it allows the body to work effectively on its own. If the body were not to work on its own, by its own inner light, the body can never be healthy. How is it that when there is a wound on the body, the white cells of the body, of the blood, they rush out to give you protection immediately? Who tells them that they have the function to prevent a bleeding? If they come into the picture, they can prevent bleeding and therefore the body is protected. Who tells the body? So there is a kind of knowledge which is present even in the movements which are unconscious. And then if you look at the whole world, you will find that the whole world is a big ocean of consciousness. You will then find that the whole world is one great ocean of consciousness. And even scientifically today, there are three or four events which have occurred which are very significant. One is that Jagdish Chandra Bose proved that in plants there is feeling, there is joy, there is sorrow. Actually, scientifically, by scientific means, by machines, he showed that plants have consciousness in them. He also wanted to show further that even in metals, there is consciousness. He could not finish his task, but that was also his further attempt, to show even in the metals there is consciousness. In any case, it is now known that metals get fatigue. Our cars, they get fatigued. So there is something like a fatigue in matter. There is something like freshness of matter. When the car is new, brand new, it moves very fast and without any trouble. But much more than that, there is a recent experiment about 10, 12 years ago which was done, which was as follows. You take a small particle of matter. This was an experiment which was conducted, and this has been now proved. You take a smallest possible particle and split it, and let one particle go in one direction, and you direct the other particle, split particle, into another direction. Thousands of miles they are separated from each other. Then you act upon this particle and change its direction. And the moment you change the direction of this particle, that particle, without your doing anything to it, it also changes the direction. This is a kind of experiment. It is called Bell's theorem. There was a scientist called Bell. He proved that this surprising phenomenon takes place. Who tells that particular this particle that its twin has been affected and it has been changed in its direction? Without being communicators, this particular particle also changes its direction without any manipulation from outside, automatically. So, in matter, there is a consciousness, at least there is communication. In life and plants, there is consciousness. In the mind, of course, there is consciousness, but not complete consciousness. In mind, there is consciousness. In the mind, there is subconscious, which is conscious. In the mind, there is subliminal, which is conscious. And then when you develop the mind and silence the mind, then a higher consciousness develops. So, in other words, at all the planes of being, right from matter to the height of consciousness, there is nothing but pure consciousness. The difference between one and the other is only a question of self-limitation. There is a limitation of consciousness, and that too by self-limitation, this limitation comes into existence. Not only that, but consciousness always implies the operation of intelligence and design. Can we say that the whole world has a design? Can we say the world has a purpose? Do events happen with a certain kind of design? This is a theory exactly opposite to chance theory. According to chance theory, events happen pell-mell. But if consciousness is at the end, is the ultimate reality, then you must be able to see design everywhere. Now, if you look at the world very minutely, you will find that in everything in the world, there is a relationship between consciousness, however dim it may be, and the design it makes. Like a bird anticipates the rainfall and prepares a nest, which every one of us can see quite easily. And the design of the nest is exactly suitable to be a resident of the bird. Who taught the bird to make the nests? And if you really see the nests, some of the nests are so beautiful and so powerful, you can't even break them easily. And actually they are made of some small branches, twigs, and very feeble fibers, but very well knit together, they become very powerful and with a good design. Actually, when we study biology, when we study vegetation, we find such a tremendous design in it. Take, for example, the design of flowers. What is the design of flowers? Every flower has a design and varieties of designs. Now, if nature was not a designer, how could such designs come about? And under each tree, the flowers has a special design belonging to that particular species. And when you see these designs, even much more minutely you will find that these designs correspond to something which is very psychological. I was recently seeing a very beautiful flower. Just recently I saw a flower. And mother had called that flower fire, Agni. And when I was examining the flower, I found in it the following design. One day if I get the flower, I'd like to show you, because very beautiful design. Each flower has four main petals. Over these four petals, there is one supervening petal. Four on this side and supervening petal as if presiding over it. And over that, another petal which is still further supervening over it. Now, when you examine this design, you find it actually accurately translates the concept of Jivatman. Jivatman is a supervening individual of which psychic being is the delegate. And psychic being has four powers of knowledge, will, harmony and skill. It has four petals. So four petals presided over by a special petal, over which there is a further special petal. And fire is actually regarded as a Jivatman, as a psychic entity. So if you examine this flower, it is not only a design, it's a design which accurately describes the relationship between the soul and its powers. One day I wish I would like to show you this flower. It is very beautiful flower. I don't know what it is.
You can look it up in Mother's book on flowers.
I'll just see because it is red color. I saw I was recently in 46 Shergill Mark. There is a garden in which this flower grows. And when I was examining, I found, and then I realized why mother called it fire.
Dear poppy has fallen.
Pardon?
But the poppy doesn't have a superimposing and another superimposing thing.
Just see. But every flower that mother has given the name is because it has a psychological connection.
But the four that you said, knowledge, will, would they correspond to body, life and mind?
No. And that's right, these four, correct. Maheshwari, correct. So, in flowers, there is so much of design, and this design corresponds to psychological aspects which are to be born later on. The human beings came onto this world much later, and these human beings manifest those levels of consciousness which are already redesigned, you might say, in the form of these flowers. Also, when we see, if you go deeper, you can find that every flower, if you really keep company of flowers, they constantly give you psychological help. They not only give the fragrance or the presence of beauty, but by keeping those flowers with you, you get a certain kind of special capacity. Like tapasya, for example, Shiva's flower, if you keep constantly with you, the power of tapasya will increase in you. It's a fact, if you keep even the smell of it, it's a smell of tapasya. It induces tapasya in your consciousness. I don't know the names of these flowers, but if you see the flowers which are normally offered to Shiva.
Champa
is a flower, mother has called it psychological perfection. Champa flower has got these four petals, the psychological perfection. Must be. I don't know the name, the biological name or whatever name.
The white color.
Yes. But those flowers, if you really smell them, you will find that the very smell is of tapasya. It induces tapasya in you. It is quite different from a rose.
But you can keep any flower, uncle, for that purpose.
You can, but I am saying that the rose in India, we have specially designed that for Shiva, you will specially offer that flower.
No, that's okay, but for your tapasya, roses will also
do. You can, but if you have this particular flower, it certainly imparts to you a very special power.
Rose must be having some other power.
It has a power of love.
Rose, when you have started, then So some days I kept flowers, but then
these flowers are very important actually in our spiritual life. So if you have certain flowers and company of certain flowers, they always give you a certain, like purity flowers, for example, Juhi, the jasmine flowers. If you just keep them with you, they will give lot of purity in your being. The very company of these flowers provide you lot of purity. So all these flowers are actually psychological conditions. Animals, they seem to be unintelligent, but actually intelligence in animals sometimes is so great. Just now I gave the example of the nest-making capacity of the birds. But like that, there are so many amazing capacities of animals and birds which human beings cannot possess. Although we pride ourselves with our consciousness and we believe that from consciousness point of view we are supreme, it is really not true. What a dog can do, you cannot do. A dog can detect a thief, which even the best policeman cannot do. What is that capacity which the dog possesses? What is the state of consciousness it possesses? What elephant can do, the human being cannot do. What the lion can do, the man cannot do. What the monkey can do, man cannot do. And in the, not only physically, but even psychologically, there are certain things which psychologically we cannot do, like it is said dolphins, for example. They have a goodwill inherent in them, which human beings don't possess. Even though we have goodwill, it is mixed up with evil will. There is rivalry, competition, this, etc. But dolphins are supposed to have a genuine goodwill. They automatically behave in such a way as to protect, to take care, and they rush up to help somebody. This has been found in many experiments regarding dolphins. So many animals possess consciousness which we human beings don't possess. The conclusion is that this force which is acting in the world is not unconscious. We examine all materialistic positions to prove that it is material. And these theories fail. We take the opposite hypothesis and we can show that everything in the world is fundamentally conscious. Therefore, our conclusion is that the force that is working in the world and the being that is behind the force is conscious. Well, this is the end of the chapter number 10, fundamentally.
But what he proved is that the force, that conscious force, can be the womb of the unconscious, or is the...
Yes, it can be, because we said by limitation.
But earlier we said that consciousness is the nature of...
Everything.
Is the nature of Sat, the pure existence.
Quite true. But it also can, by limitation, the force is capable of two movements, either of remaining manifest or remaining unmanifest. And when it manifests, it can play many kinds of games of complete self-limitation, partial self-limitation, or growing self-limitation. A complete self-limitation is inconscience. Partial self-limitation is ignorance. And a growing self-limitation is ignorance moving towards knowledge. So it can have all kinds of conditions by power of self-limitation.
Is it wrong to say that the mind is the factor in the human being for the self-limitation?
It is not wrong, because mind itself is a power of consciousness.
Is this statement correct?
Namely,
that mind is, in the human realm, the mind is the limiting factor of consciousness.
You can say that mind, first of all, let us define mind. In order to make your statement true, you have to say what is mind. We can say mind is a special power of consciousness. Consciousness has originally two powers, of comprehending consciousness and of having simultaneous consciousness of each and every element. Comprehending consciousness means universal consciousness. And another capacity of being conscious of each and every element in that consciousness. It is universal consciousness and it is omniscience. Omniscience means knowledge of each and everything. These are the two original powers of consciousness. These two powers combined together is what is called supermind. Supermind can be defined as an all-comprehensive consciousness, which is capable of being conscious of each and every element within itself. Now, when this consciousness decides to limit itself, then it produces what is called apprehending consciousness. Not comprehending, but apprehending. Now, what is apprehending consciousness? Apprehending consciousness is a consciousness that emphasizes one thing against the other. It concentrates upon one more than on the other. Therefore, exclusive becomes afterwards, but at present is only, it gives more importance to one rather than to the other. It is still conscious of everything, but it gives more importance to one instead of to the other.
Is that the realm of duality?
This is not yet the realm of duality. Not yet. It comes about as a result of this. This is simply a kind of a play. The same comprehending consciousness, which was equal, spread over everything, giving equal consciousness to everything, now begins to play in such a way, it gives a greater attention to one as against to the other. Take for example, the greatest figure that we have got is of Raslila, of Sri Krishna. Sri Krishna, with so many gopis, hundreds of them. But Sri Krishna is playing with each one of them. Now, when this play of Sri Krishna is equal in with every gopi, it is, you might say, the supramental activity. But Sri Krishna is capable of playing more with this than with that. It can make a distinction between Radha and others, more with this, less with that. Now more with this one, now more with that one. It is not as if only less for others. That which was receiving less attention now can get more attention later on. So it can be various kinds of play, in which the attention or concentration which is given to one varies in various degrees. Now this capacity of giving more attention and less attention is what is called apprehending consciousness, as opposed to comprehending consciousness. In comprehending consciousness, the consciousness is spread equally on all. That is the highest game, you might say, of the supramental, in which everyone is exclusive with the divine, perfectly with the divine, and no difference everywhere, perfect equality. But this equality is not inconsistent with special kind of attention on one as against on the other. We have seen this example when a mother has got 3 children or 5 children. That all the children are equally loved is inwardly true in the consciousness of the mother. And yet the mother can vary the concentration on one child or the other. Now on this child, now on that child, now on that child, depending upon the circumstances. And although there is partiality at that moment, basically there is no partiality. Because each child gets the same kind of partiality at one time or the other. And fundamentally, inwardly, all the children are equally loved by the mother. So there is an equality of love. There is special partiality now, special partiality then, with one or the other, which also goes on changing from time to time. Therefore, both the games are equally possible, and the whole world is nothing but a game of comprehending equality and apprehending inequality. But both simultaneously. The entire world is nothing but comprehending equality and apprehending inequality. But both when they are together, there is no ignorance. Now when the apprehending consciousness shuts out or veils the comprehending, not abolishes it, but only veils it, then this apprehending consciousness, which is a play of partiality, becomes prominent. That prominent activity of apprehending consciousness is what we call mind. The definition of mind is apprehending consciousness acting in the state of inequality, from where the sense of equality of comprehensive consciousness is veiled.
That is why balance of mind is...
That's right. Now that is the real root of yoga. Why yoga is necessary? Why meditation is necessary? Because our inequalities of consciousness, our apprehending consciousness can come to a stillness. Then when you open up inward, then you see the equality of consciousness, comprehending consciousness. And when you can combine both together, you can have exactly, you can be like Sri Krishna yourself and have the play of both the kinds. Equal to all the gopis, unequal to every one of them, unequal now to one, unequal to another then. All kinds of possibilities, permutations and combinations are possible. And the whole world is nothing but Rasa Leela of Sri Krishna.
The play of Sri Krishna as in the Rasa Leela is the realization of the play of Jivatma.
That's right. Precisely. When you are liberated from the ignorance, that is when your apprehending consciousness is opened up, not abolished, but opened up. That is why avidya and vidya both are together. Avidya is apprehending consciousness and the vidya is of comprehensive consciousness. When both are together, then you get the complete knowledge. So this whole world is nothing but a sea of consciousness, but differently constituted by the special power of limitation of consciousness. Therefore, your statement that ignorance is due to the mind is quite true, provided by mind you mean what I just now defined. The mind is an apprehending consciousness. When it begins to concentrate unequally upon different points of consciousness, veiling the comprehending equal consciousness which is behind, then what we call ignorance arises. Now I think I shall stop here today because I have to go early. But I will now request you to read the chapter number 10. I have told you everything that is in chapter number 10. We shall read also some portions next time when I come, some passages, just to emphasize those passages. And then we shall go to the next two chapters. The delight of existence, problem, and delight of existence, the solution. All right.